We are the Cat's Whiskers, and this is my top line. Hello and welcome to My Top Line. I'm Jonathan Bullard. Second edition of this new podcast from the Cat's Whiskers. And I'm delighted to say that our guest for this episode is none other than Mr. Andy Awood. Andy, how are you?
Not too bad, thank you very much. How are you about yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for coming on. A great lineup that you've chosen. Has a little bit of a theme going through it, I think, that people will find out. But I think it's fair to say you are more of a fan of the rougher side of the game. I think that's fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It is what first attracted me to the sport, as you'll find out later. And it's something that throughout my time coming, it's sort of the aspect of the game that I like. It's an aspect of the game that I appreciate is dwindling a bit, but every now and then you get that glimpse of hope where you sign a player that takes you back a little bit to the olden days, as it were. And it's exciting. It's there's a stadium full of people, and whenever two people drop the gloves, so there's a big hit, there's an atmosphere that erupts that you don't see for the other sort of 59 minutes other than goals going in. So it always gets talked about as being part of a game that should be going, but whenever it happens, you see so many thousand people completely engrossed and on their feet clapping and cheering. So yeah, I love it.
Before we get on to your team, just find out a little bit more about your hockey watching history. So, big fan of the Nottingham Panthers, as I think most people will know from your appearances on the Cat's Whiskers podcast. But also, when was your first game?
My first game was the 3rd of October 2001, and it was Panthers versus Sheffield, and we lost 2-1.
Yes, and if I remember rightly, was that the game where Scott Allison and Barry Nykoff faced each other for the first time after the Blench clearance?
It is indeed, and obviously as a 12-year-old boy, I was completely unaware of anything that had happened before. So basically my parents were decorating their bedroom. I was at school, I came home from school, and they'd had the radio on, and they'd mentioned about the fact that Panthers were playing Sheffield, and my parents had said, did I want to go? And I said, yes, why not? You know, nothing else sort of to do. So we went, and it was just a complete buzz. It was something I'd never seen before in terms of the general sort of experience of ice hockey. You know, I'd been to football games before, various stadiums around the country, but it was coming to the hockey that really sort of opened my eyes a little bit in terms of how great it was. And obviously, as you mentioned, it's the first time that Nykoff and Allison had seen each other since the bench clearance. But obviously, when I stepped into that arena for the first time, I had no idea about any of that. I had no idea about the actual sport itself, what to expect, and was just completely blown away by it. And like I say, so that's, 19 seasons now, I think, where I've been coming back. And I certainly think from that first game I went to in 2001, certainly for probably the next 7 or 8 seasons, at the very least, I didn't miss a home match. And then obviously there were spells where I probably did most of the away games as well. But it was definitely something that sort of hooked me straight away.
Okay, we're going to move straight on to your team, starting with the netminder. So, Andy, who is your choice of netminder?
It's Rastislav Rovnianek.
Rastislav Rovnianek, who played 54 games for the Panthers over the 2006-07 and the 2007-08 season. A great season in 6-7. He came in halfway through the season, 27 games for a goals against average of 2.37 and a 92.1% save percentage in league games. Then in the playoffs, 4 games, a 1.65 goals against average, and a 95.1% save average in those 4 playoff games. Of course, 2007-08 wasn't as good for him, and he ended up getting replaced by Tomaski. But Andy, why particularly have you chosen Rovnianek?
Well, I don't know if it's to do with my age at the time or just generally. It'd be interesting to hear your opinion on this, but he was the first goalie I saw from when I started going. Obviously, in the second year of the arena, I'd never seen Trevor Robbins. He was the first goalie that made me realise how crucial a role the goalie was. So for the first sort of five or six years that I'd been going, it was all about scoring goals. It was all about, you know, having tough guys and really skillful players and stuff like that. And I never really thought much about the defence or defencemen and obviously subsequently netminders. And obviously that season we started off with Evan Lindsay, I believe, and it didn't go well. And we replaced him with this guy who came in. He was quite old. He couldn't speak any English. He wore number 4, which completely blew my mind because I was like, is this guy a joke? I know I hadn't been around the game for too long at this point, but I've been around long enough to realize that goalies don't tend to wear number 4. And he sort of completely revolutionized netminding for me in terms of how I viewed it. I can't remember the game, but there was a play where a player dumped a puck towards his net, and it was coming straight towards him, and there was a forward chasing after it, and it was really quite close as to who was going to get there first in terms of, was the player going to get there, was Rasta going to go out and try and challenge him, was he going to stay in his net and just let him get the puck and fancy his chances on the breakaway. But he sort of skated out a little bit and just angled his stick ever so slightly, and the puck just deflected off his stick, and he just casually put his hand out and caught it in his catching glove. And I'd never seen something so ridiculous in my life. Like, the calmness and the experience of him was just something to behold. And ultimately, you know, that 7-8 season, I think he was probably found out a little bit, in the sense of, I think people realised what to expect from him. But going into that season when he came in halfway through, for me, netminding, they'd always been goalies that sort of stayed around the crease and they just waited for the shot to come in. Whereas Russell was the first goalie I sort of noticed that was coming out and challenging players. He was poke checking players on breakaways. He was skating out and skating towards players and putting the pressure and the onus on them. And it just sort of changed the way I sort of viewed things. And obviously on the back of that, the whole playoff experience that we went through that season, it was quite phenomenal. You know, we won the quarterfinals, the semifinals, and the final on penalty shots, and ultimately he was a massive reason of that. And as much as sometimes you sit there thinking it's a bit tedious and a bit tiring, it's 2020 and we still do that thing after the game that he brought in. He's had whether you like it or not, he's had a lasting legacy on this club. I don't doubt that he's not the best netminder I've ever seen. You know, Craig Kowalski fits that bill in terms of the netminders that I've seen. But I think the thing with Rasta was he was so different to what I'd been used to. And he was the first netminder that I'd seen that made me interested in watching netminders. You know, he would make miraculous saves. He would do ridiculous things. We went to Belfast. I think we lost the game 7-3 or 7-4. And we were awful throughout the game. And there was one point where I think they'd scored a goal that he'd either thought was a man in the crease or it was with a high stick, and he went crazy at Nigel Boniface. And obviously, I'm guessing, completely in Slovakian, so no one could really do anything about it, but he probably called him every name under the sun. And then in the next sort of play, the net was off, but it was only off by like 3 or 4 inches, if that. It had been knocked but not been fully removed. And he kept trying to get Boniface's attention as the play broke down to the Belfast end of the ice. So obviously, Rasta was trying to get the attention of the referees to sort of say, look, the net's off, stop the play or come and sort it out, because he wasn't going to do it. And nothing happened. So when Belfast then broke back into the zone, he was waving his arms around, trying to get attention. And as soon as he realised he wasn't going to get it, he just turned around and pushed the net right across to the boards and just stood there and just went, the net's not on. And I just never seen anything quite so audacious from a netminder. It was just bizarre. But at the same time, he was good. You know, he'd got that experience. And he'd played at pretty high levels throughout his career. But obviously, we caught him at his probably past his prime. But he was still pretty damn good for what I was used to watching my hockey.
Yeah, I think you're right when you say he was someone who you've probably not seen like that before, who played in that style. I always remember when Paul Barmy used to say that he always caught down rather than catching up and put the puck on the ice. It was a very, very different style that he had, and he had that unique goalie helmet that was blue with just a like a junior face yeah. cage on it. It wasn't like a normal netminder helmet, but he was a massive part of us winning that playoff title in 2007.
Absolutely. I think realistically, other than Trevor Gallant, he was probably the most important player in that whole playoff run. When we brought Gallant in the back end of that season, it was a statement of intent that we were making a push to win the playoffs. But I think as much as everyone ups their game in the playoffs, and certainly we saw players up their game quite measurably in that playoff series, I think Rasta was just different class. And ultimately, like I say, when it goes down to penalty shootout and you win three on the bounce like that, you can only really look at your netminder and say, thank you very much, well done.
Yeah, 9 penalty shots he faced, he saved every single one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to leave Rasto there and move on to your first defenceman. So, Andy, defenceman number one, please.
From the same season, I've picked Mike Rees.
Mike Rees, 51 games for the Panthers in the 2006-07 season, had previously captained the Bracknell Bees as well. He scored 4 goals and 12 assists and 191 penalty minutes. So why Mike Rees?
Because he was scary. We sort of affectionately called him Scary Mike Rees because he was quite a nasty person. I remember in Hull, we went to a game in Hull, and we were queuing up to go in when the team bus pulled in, and players got off the bus and that, and they're walking past us and things like that. And some of the people we were with were talking to Mike Rees, and he actually said to one of them, which player should I go for today? So I sort of looked in shock. I was just sort of like, oh wow, they said a name, and sure enough, in that game he went straight for him. And it was dirty in a sense of, it was things like cross checks and constantly just being there and just being in his face. And as soon as the whistle would go, he'd give him a quick jab, or he'd give him a quick push, or the glove would go in the face along the boards, you know, the stick would be in his back and things like that. And I think he went through a spell that season as well of getting into fights with Hull players and having them dislocate shoulders. I'm sure he had 2 that season where Hull players ended up injured on the back of fighting Mike Rees.
Yeah, I seem to recall that he did injure a couple of players, but I'm sure if there's any former Stingrays fans listening, they can tweet in and tell us who it was, because I don't recall off the top of my head at the minute.
I have a feeling Jake Riddle might have been one, and I can't think who the other one was, but I for some reason I've got it in my head that he had 2 fights, both in Hull, and both players ended up being injured from the fights. And my first recollection of Mike Rees was we went to Romford for a pre-season game. And I don't know if anyone's been to Romford, but where the players' bench is, there's stairs. They go up and then they get to like a peak, and then they go down to the bench. Like a set of stairs up from the dressing room to the top, and then like 2 or 3 stairs down to the players' bench, I'm guessing, if my memory is right. And the players have started coming onto the ice. You've got people like Patrico and Rod Stevens and Evan Lindsay at the time and stuff like that. And then Mike Rees sort of runs out and he falls down the stairs. And I immediately remember thinking, what the hell have we signed here? And he's been one of my favourite players ever since. And, you know, he just... That playoff series against Sheffield, that home leg against Sheffield in the playoffs, he was absolutely incredible. Just, if anyone got within 10 feet of Rovnjanek, they were going to know about it. And he just pushed people away. He was just getting in people's faces. There's that famous part of that game where Regan Darby jumps into Dave Pager's photograph booth and punches Ryan Schmier. The reaction from Pager is hilarious as he's cradling his camera, trying to make sure he keeps that safe. And Woolhouse is sort of like quite shocked. And Schmier's sort of there in a sort of, shall I go for it or shall I not? And then all out of nowhere, because he's down the far end of the bench, you just see Mike Rees absolutely run past Schmier trying to get at him. and it personified him. He was up for it every game, and he wasn't going to back down from anyone. And he wasn't the biggest guy by any stretch, but he played the game incredibly physically. And as a defenseman, it's one of the things I like in my defense. I like them to be physical. I want to see defensemen that clear out the crease and get stuck in. And Mike Rees did all of that.
We'll leave Mike Rees there. Clearly, you have a lot of fond memories of him, as I think most of us do, from that great playoff winning season. But we're going to move on to your favourite game now. So, Andy, what is your favourite Panthers game of all time?
My favourite Panthers game of all time is what I believe is the greatest playoff final of all time, which is the 2011 playoff final against Cardiff.
Panthers winning by 5-4. Of course, they were 2 goals down twice in that game before David Alexandre Beauregard came up with the winner in the third period. And of course, in the semi-final against the Sheffield Steelers, Panthers were 2 goals down but pulled that back, winning in overtime thanks to Robert Lakovich. So why particularly that game? What was it about that game that made it so special for you?
Well, I think as a Panthers fan, winning the playoffs was an incredible feeling. But I think that the whole roller coaster of emotions that we went through in that playoff final was like something else that we'd not seen before. Obviously, we'd been in tense. Well, I say we'd never seen it before. I'd never seen it before. I'd been in tense finals. Obviously, we talked about Rasta in the playoffs. Obviously, that was a draw going into a shootout. That was pretty nail biting. I think that season as well, Cardiff had gone on that ridiculous winning streak. They'd got Craig Weller and brought him in, and he'd made a massive difference. And they were, I believe, they were incredibly close to winning the league that year.
I think Sheffield won it by a point, or it was level on points, and it was a tie-break situation. It was incredibly close.
And obviously, for a spell, they were not even close to being in it. But that whole run that they went on, it made world news, I believe.
It was a world record at the time.
Like 22 games or something like that. And they were really good. They'd got some incredibly good players. And we went 2-0 down, and then we scored a redirected goal by Beauregard to bring it back. And then they scored again. And the third goal to make it 3-1 was 32 seconds into the second period. So we went into the second period 2-1 down, and then we start. Infinity scores within the first 30 seconds or so, and you automatically think, oh, it's just going to be one of them days. We just can't seem to, you know, stop conceding goals, and this team are too good. But we battled back, and we battled back through two ridiculous goals. So Gerard Adams gives a puck away to Galbraith behind the net, just completely unforced error and really bizarre. He just turns it over and passes it to Galbraith, who then finds Myers in front, and he manages to score. And then,
quickly before you move on to the next one, I think that goal was probably less than a minute after Cardiff had gone 3-1 ahead, right at the start of the second period, if my memory serves me correctly.
Right. Okay.
So clearly, that was a massively important time to get back within one goal so soon.
Huge.
After Cardiff had gone ahead by 2 goals.
Definitely, because I think as well, particularly if you go 2 goals down, and then you go 2 goals down twice, you have to make sure you get the next one, because it starts to become, you know, no matter how good the team is, it starts to become insurmountable. And just the feeling of if you don't score, and the other team has got that cushion, it just heaps the pressure on you so much that it becomes vital. But I mean, of all the players to give the puck away to behind the net, Galbraith would be the first choice on most people in most teams' list to be able to set up a pass from behind the net. So we were quite lucky with that one. And then if we were lucky with that one, the equalising goal was just a farce almost. So Nielsen chips the puck from our own zone, and it's bouncing, and Harima just gets a stick on it, and it somehow sort of bundles past Stevie Lyle and sort of like rolls up a Cardiff player's stick and goes over his pad and under his catcher. And somehow we've managed to pull it back. But then we get that dagger where Brad Voss scores, and we go into the third period trailing again. So, you know, we've already had this emotional rollercoaster already by being down, and then we finally managed to pull it back. And then they go down the other end and score again. And like I say, you just get that feeling that it's just going to be one of them days where no matter how close you manage to keep it, they're just going to keep going down the other end and scoring. And then third period, Billy Ryan goes coast to coast and great scores. Goal. Absolutely fantastic goal. And I wasn't overly struck on Billy Ryan that season, but that is a goal that, you know, is etched into my memory. It was superb. And then the winning goal was just, it was just fantastic. You know, it was, we'd got Kachuk, Karima and Beauregard on a line and they really clicked, and we managed to win the face off, get a shot off. I think it was saved, and then we worked the puck around a bit, and then from a tight angle, Beauregard just manages to find the tiniest of gaps through Stevie Lyle's legs.
Yeah, because Lyle had lost his stick, hadn't he?
Yeah.
And I think that just left that gap where normally his stick would have been.
Absolutely. And I think, ultimately, there's nobody else on the ice. Maybe John Pelle, who was at Cardiff that year, who probably could have scored that goal. It personified Beauregard. Of just pure goal-scoring genius. He knew where the net was, he knew where the gaps were, and if you got him a puck and he had that opportunity, he was going to score because the angle was against him. You know, I think there might have been another player sort of, not necessarily in between him and Stevie Lyle, but sort of in the way, and he just had that ability to find the net. And I think, looking at all the finals that I've seen since I've been coming, I just think that obviously, from a Cardiff fan's perspective, that must have been a devastating game to watch. I appreciate that. But it was a very good game to watch. As a Panthers fan, obviously, it was pure elation. But I think as a neutral as well, or maybe not Sheffield neutral, but as a neutral, it was such a good game to watch because it ebbed and flowed. It was physical and it was a really good game. And I think, like I say, in my opinion, it's the best playoff final that I've ever seen. And I think with it being the showcase, you know, like the final piece of the Elite League season, the fact we won it and the fact that the game was so good, that's why it's my favourite game.
Great stuff. I don't think I can really add anything to what you've just said there, because it was an absolutely fantastic game of hockey with, I think, every emotion you went through. And I think it's a great choice.
We did sort of try and keep it interesting towards the end as well, because I think Craig Weller took a penalty in like the last 2.5 minutes. So we were on the power play going into the end of it, and then inexplicably we let them have the puck with like 15 seconds left just as Weller came out the box. And obviously they clear the zone, and for some reason, rather than staying in his net, Kowalski skates out to beat the puck. And I think Finnerty's chasing it down and Weller's there and there's collision. Watching it back now, because you know what happens and you see where the puck goes, it's fine. But I remember at the time thinking, my God, the puck's loose and the net's completely empty. And if the refs haven't called that as a penalty on for hitting Kowalski, they've got an empty net to shoot at. And there's still 10 seconds on the clock. And you sort of think, we had this in the bag 2 minutes ago. We're just keeping it exciting, I believe, is what I like to think of it as.
Yeah, which was a trademark, I suppose, of your next choice and your second defenceman, who, of course, the architect of a lot of success for the Nottingham Panthers. So, Andy, who is defenceman number two for you?
Corey Nielsen.
Corey Nielsen, of course, 403 games, 85 goals and 300 assists for the Nottingham Panthers. Won 14 trophies overall as a player and a coach. 12 of those as a coach, but the full list is 1 Elite League title, 1 Continental Cup, 5 playoffs and 7 Challenge Cups. So, Andy, Corey Nielsen, over to you.
I'm going to say something quite outlandish here, in that I think he's the best defenseman I've ever seen play for Panthers. Now, I appreciate that I've seen Jimmy Pack, but when I saw Jimmy Pack play, I was 12 and 13, so I didn't appreciate quite how good he was. And then, obviously, since then, we'd had other defensemen. And I'm sure that it will be a debate that will go on till the end of time. But in my time span, he was just different class. He came in with the hype and the CV. And I remember Mike Ellis saying that he was too good for this league. And that first season, I think he struggled. But then I mentioned about players in that playoff series, sort of up in their game. and he really did. It was a such an odd transformation because he went from being sort of, you could tell he'd got talent and you could tell he was good, but for some reason it just didn't click throughout most of the season. And then that playoff series, he was just absolutely incredible. And
well,
I remember
he went
when,
zero to hero, really, didn't he? In a very short space of time.
So he scored the penalty shot against Sheffield. He scored the winning penalty shot against Sheffield in that quarter final for the playoffs. And I remember when they announced his name, I sort of thought, oh, wow, Nielsen. I mean, we've got a team full of goal scorers and we've gone for a defenseman. And he scored. And I think, did he score against, who'd be playing the semis? Was it Belfast?
Yeah, he scored against Belfast.
It was
Nielsen and McCancel, and Nielsen and McCancel, and then Gallant missed both, and then Gallant scored in the final.
Yeah, because I remember saying that, I remember hearing that Corey had played with Phil O'Sair at, I think, Pensacola, maybe, and he said whilst he'd got in his mind, he knew what he wanted to do and was trying to do it. He said afterwards, he said. He kind of felt like O'Sair probably knew his tells and knew what he would try and do. And obviously he saved it. But I just think generally his overall game from that playoff series to when he hung up the skates and retired in 2012-13 season, he was just a completely different class. And yes, you know, certainly towards the end, the legs went and he got slower and he took a lot of like hooking penalties and things like that. But he was still racking up points. He got 300 assists for Panthers and 85 goals over his 403 games across all competitions. And it was numbers like I'd not seen before from defencemen.
Well, for a defenceman to score almost a point a game.
Yeah.
Even when you go back to then, and you can probably legitimately say the standard of the Elite League wasn't as good as what it is now. But even so, for a defenseman to be scoring nearly a point a game is nothing short of phenomenal.
No, absolutely. You know, and he was fun to watch. You know, he was great because whenever, you know, particularly on the power play and things like that, where you'd get him on that point. And you could see things working. And I think it particularly clicked, obviously, the year we won the league, because I think we went about 25% on the power play. But there was that spell where they do the crossover of, you know, Clark and Nielsen on the point, and you genuinely didn't know which one of them was going to shoot. It was great to have such options at the point that it made it so much more difficult for the defending team, you know. And don't get me wrong, obviously, I think certainly towards the end of, you know, his playing career, people caught wind of what was happening a little bit and things like that. For me, he was phenomenal and really, really good. And you know, in terms of, obviously, this is obviously my top line, so in terms of playing, I think he's the best defenseman I saw, certainly from an age where I sort of feel like I understood hockey a bit better. But also, you know, coaching side, again, I know it's early days still technically because it's only been two seasons since he's gone. A bad season was winning the Continental Cup. That's arguably one of the worst seasons I've seen, and we came away with a trophy in Europe. You know, he's raised the bar massively for hockey in Nottingham in terms of trophy output. You know, from the years I first started coming, we didn't win anything for a few years. Then we won the Challenge Cup in Sheffield with our Roos scoring that goal. And then there was nothing for a couple of years before we won the playoffs. And then obviously when Corey took over, it became almost regular. It was a feature. Was silverware. You know, I just think he was integral to that. Particularly, obviously, like I say, as a coach. But I think certainly in those early years as well, when we're winning the cup doubles, and then, you know, the five Challenge Cups in a row and the three playoffs in a row, he was integral to that on the ice.
Probably one of the best defensemen in the Elite League era, certainly in terms of point scoring as well. Do you feel that's fair, or do you think there's anyone around the league you could say was better?
If you're building an elite league, an all elite league roster of players that have spent, you know, not necessarily a huge amount of time here, but certainly more than just like your one season, so then they disappear. He's 100%. He's on that list. But you've got to think, you know, players like Jonathan Weaver potentially in Coventry. I think Corey even said if you're going to retire and sign Jonathan Weaver, because he's the only player in the league that was better than him at doing what he did. You know, and then obviously there's what you want from a defenseman as well. So, you know, like, he's a completely different defenseman to someone like Mike Rees, for instance. You know, so you think about people like that Sheffield have had, particularly in the past, like Steve Munn or Bolly Brook on his first stint. Potentially there's an argument there that they probably make the top defensive line potentially. But for me, he would be in it 100%. And I don't think it's a surprise that he was one of the people that was picked for the Boston Bruins game. He fits that bill. He's elite league royalty, whether people like it or not.
Okay, as we're talking about players from other teams, we're going to ask you, who is your player from another team who you would have loved to have seen play in Nottingham? So, Andy, what you've got a couple of choices, but there's some good stories around these.
Yeah, I'm cheating a little bit because Dennis Maxwell springs to mind because he's probably still is my all-time favourite non-Panthers player.
Okay, let's go with Maxwell first then, before we reveal your second
one. Yeah. So the thing with Maxwell was I loved the way he played. I loved the way he coached, particularly when he was at London Races. and he was great fun. He was entertainment. He'd score goals. I think he was just under a point a game in the Elite League. He'd been around the ISL. Obviously, he scored that goal that knocked us out of a playoff semi-final with, like, was it 0.2 seconds to go or 0.4 seconds to go, something like that, when he was at London Knights. He was physical. He was no nonsense. He'd fight. Obviously, he had that fantastic scrap with Christian Gosselin where he then climbed over broke the glass between the penalty boxes and climbed into the Bracknell Bees penalty box to fight Christian Gosselin. And I loved it. I thought it was great. You know, I went to Coventry a few times to go see London play when he was at London. I mean, admittedly, there was more of a draw than Dennis Maxwell that year because it was Wade Bielak and Eric Cairns, particularly were big draws to go and watch. But the reason why I kind of feel like he's cheating is because he did play for us. He played one game against Cologne Sharks. Yes, and scored.
Yes, it's after 71 seconds, I think it was. Very, very early on in the game. And he wore 71.
He wore 71. Yeah, so we played Cologne Sharks, and I think we had Martin Massa, Rod Saric, Mark Dutiem, and Dennis Maxwell played in that game. And it was actually Maxwell's last game in the UK that he played.
I think he was sacked the day after.
And obviously he scored a goal. And then at the end of the year, when Panthers did their shirt auctions, I managed to get Dennis Maxwell's only game-worn Panther shirt for £30, and it's my most prized shirt out of all the ones I own. One, because it was so cheap, and two, because it was Maxwell. But the reason why I've chose him is because I was actually on holiday when we played Cologne Sharks, so I still have never seen Dennis Maxwell play for Panthers. So that's why he's in. But technically, he did play for Panthers. So I also throw in a second one, which would be Matthew Waugh from Sheffield.
Matthew Waugh, 302 games for 162 goals and 162 assists. That is, of course, his combined total at the Sheffield Steelers, where he had four seasons and one at the Glasgow Clan this season just gone. He won two Elite League titles and a playoff title. They were all at the Steelers. So what was so special about Matthew Waugh for you?
He just seemed to win every game and was clutch in doing so. He would score big goals. He would win crucial face-offs. He would play with a physical edge for someone that was so small. Just annoying. I used to hate him because he was so good. He was so good around the net. For someone that's so small, and you think of some of the defensemen that he would have come up against in terms of their size, and you just sort of think, you just move him out of the way. But his body positioning, his strength, his core strength, and his balance, he was always the first person to a loose puck if the puck was around the crease, and always seemed to score. And I hated that. But I would have loved to have seen that for us. And I do think as well that we went through a spell where we didn't really have a player like that that you could sort of, you could chuck on the ice and you were almost guaranteed to get the face off. Or you were losing a game by a goal and that last 5 minutes, you knew that they would create at least two or three good chances and the possibility and probability of them scoring. And for a time, whenever we played for him, he just seemed to always be on the score sheet. He was a winner. He does fit that sort of Sheffield mentality of players, in that, you know, he goes all out and above and beyond to get the win, whether it's sort of legal or slightly illegal in terms of play. But he's damn good, and ultimately that's why I'd have liked to have seen him.
Although I must admit, my favourite story about Matthew Waugh is when he returned to Sheffield with the Glasgow Clan earlier this season, won the game, and went off wearing a Burger King crown to say he wasn't the King of Sheffield anymore.
And seemingly has a sense of humour, so there you go.
Exactly. Okay, let's go on to your forward lines now. And I think the first one you've chosen may raise a few eyebrows. So who is the first forward in your forward lines?
My first forward in my forward lines is Barry Nicar.
Barry Nicar. We've got his Ice Hockey Super League and playoff stats, 132 games, 15 goals, 29 assists, 671 penalty minutes in three seasons playing for the Panthers. As I said, it's probably an unusual choice, bearing in mind that as a forward, he wasn't a prolific point scorer. He was a prolific penalty minute gatherer, and he certainly wasn't popular outside of Nottingham. So why Barry Nicar?
Well, a few things. I think ultimately the fact that this is my top line, not my pick of the best players that have played for Panthers, because he would be nowhere near that. But as I mentioned earlier on, my first game was that Panthers Steelers game where he fought Scott Allison. We lost the game 2-1, and Allison actually scored the winning goal, if I remember correctly. But I'd just gone into the rink as a 12-year-old boy and witnessed Barry Nicar absolutely annihilate Scott Allison. There's a spell towards the end of that fight where he gets his right hand free and delivers two uppercuts and then an overhand right that I feel just watching. And ultimately, that was the reason I wanted to go again. And that's the reason why I went back every week, was because I'd never seen anything like it. And for the first season, I got a Panther shirt for Christmas, and I went and got Nicar on my back. And then the year after, when I got a shirt at the start of the season, I went and got Nicar on my back. And no hesitation at all. And ultimately, you know, as we mentioned, he was never going to make anyone's best Panthers team ever. But at the time, he was my first sort of hockey idol. He was what I enjoyed and the reason why I kept going back for more. There was many a game where you'd see him dropping the gloves or throwing a hit or just generally being in someone's face, mouthing off. And it was exciting. As a kid, it was great. I loved it.
Can you see why he wasn't well-liked, especially amongst the fan bases of Sheffield? Latterly, in his Panthers career, wasn't very well-liked in Belfast, to say the least. Can you sort of understand why he built up that hatred almost?
Because, I mean, ultimately, he's always going to be the type of pantomime villain against any team, regardless. But I think, obviously, what had happened in Nottingham with Sheffield, with the bench clearance and things like that, and then obviously the brawl in Belfast, you know, completely, it takes it that one, maybe two steps beyond pantomime villain. You know, we used to have it with people like Andre Payet and things like that, where it was that sort of, you know, initially it started out that it was a bit of a nuisance and he'd scrap and you sort of didn't like him because of it. But then as things sort of progress and he starts doing more and more things, completely understandable why other teams hated him. He knew what he was doing. He was from that sort of old school era where hockey was completely different. And obviously the amount of times that you would see a fight or a brawl, and before he's even got involved, he's already shirtless. You know, you don't see that anymore. The amount of times you'd see a fight and Barry Nicar would have his pads, his shirt would be off. He'd just either have his that sort of singlet vest thing, or just be completely shirtless, so that people couldn't hold on to him, and he'd just throw punches. Like I say, as a boy who'd never seen it before, it just completely blew my mind. it completely hooked me. It really did. It was coming home from that game after we played Sheffield. I just remember going to school the next day and just telling my friends, like, I went to the ice hockey over the weekend, and just, it was incredible. This guy just absolutely battered somebody, and he just got sent into a box for 5 minutes, and then he came back out, and the place was loving it, and it was mental. And obviously, you know, you're sort of telling these stories to kids, and they're all like in awe, because you've not heard anything like it before, unless obviously you'd been to the hockey and seen it. Yeah, he was my first hockey hero.
I think that's a great place to leave Barry Nicar there, and we'll move on to your favourite goal. So, Andy, your favourite goal in all your time watching Panthers?
I've gone for Brian McGrattan in the playoffs against Sheffield.
What a fabulous goal, and I think most people will know about that. So what is it particularly about that goal that makes it your favourite?
I think it's sort of a bit like when I mentioned in the Cardiff game, it's that rollercoaster of emotions. I think in terms of a goal, it literally has almost every aspect of hockey involved from start to finish. And it's just the most surreal moment I think I've witnessed. We signed a guy who's played 300 NHL games, and yes, he was an enforcer, but we kind of thought, oh wow, we signed a proper NHLer here.
And this was a guy who could play. He definitely could play.
But he was really slow to hit the ground, I think. And I think there was a spell where a lot of people were sort of saying, you know, he's not good. He's not. Yeah, he's fighting a bit, but we thought he'd be better at hockey, and he really isn't. And then he had a spell where he started scoring a lot, and I think he went through that spell sort of around the second round of the Continental Cup, and sort of brought that form back to the league and started picking up some goals and some assists and that, and became quite a useful player. But then that goal against Sheffield is just absolutely mind blowing. So I think we scored to go 3-0 up. And then from that face off, Fitzgerald offers him out, and he sort of turns it down and skates off. Sheffield end up with the puck in our zone, and then McGrattan goes back to retrieve it, and Fitzgerald comes in to try and hit him. And then there's a scuffle along the boards. Fitzgerald's desperate to trying to get him to fight. And then there's that whole sort of pantomime scene of McGrattan turning him around and sort of shooing him away with his hand, like really motioning, like, no, I'm not going to fight you. Go away, go away. And then we break down the other end, and they're still sort of at neutral ice, jawing at each other. And then it's almost like he just notices, like, oh, there's a massive open space there. I'm just going to skate into it. And he gets the puck in the slot. And rather than shooting, he just holds onto it and just skates towards the right face-off dot. And then, you know, the netminder's on his back already at this point, because he's anticipated for shot. There's a defenseman in the way, but he just places it into the bottom of that net, and it's just probably the wildest goal I think I've seen celebrated, other than like a cup winning goal or the league winning goal, because it was just so absolutely crazy. We just witnessed a guy try and start a fight and get completely mugged off, and then the bloke that he's tried to fight has just gone up the other end and scored, and then just sort of, you can see the elation in his face and just the sheer joy of the moment. And if that was scripted in a film like Slapshot or Mighty Ducks or something, you'd sort of chuckle about how unrealistic it was. And the fact we saw it live in the flesh, it was just absolutely mind-blowing. It's just a shame, obviously, that, you know, the next night we ended up crashing and burning. But at the time, going 4-0 up in a cup quarter-final first leg, and witnessing a goal like that to put us 4-0 up was just absolutely phenomenal. It really took the wind out of our sails that night.
Absolutely phenomenal goal. Your second forward now, and who is choice number two of your forward lines?
It's Bruce Richardson.
Bruce Richardson, who of course played for Panthers 2008-09 and 2009-10 season, 126 games, 35 goals, 95 assists for 130 points, 275 penalty minutes, and of course was part of the Challenge Cup winning side in 2010 before he left Panthers to become the first coach of a brand new club called Brayhead Clan. So, Andy, why Bruce?
Because I loved him, basically. He was fantastic to watch. He was entertainment personified. He wasn't as good a player as Ling by any stretch, but he was sort of in the same mold of that old school, small, ratty, in your face type of player. But he still racked up points, but he just didn't rack up like 100 points a season. I think did he get up to like 70 odd points in his first season, I think, maybe.
Yes, I think he was definitely more than a point a game player.
Yeah. You know, so he was a real top quality player, but he was also a proper rink rat. And again, I don't think until he came that I'd seen a player quite like that. Now, I'd seen, obviously, you know, we talk about players like Nykar and stuff like that. We went through the whole sort of enforcers and things like that. But I can't remember a player that was sort of small, niggly, annoying, agitating, just a real wind-up merchant, just constant.
But could back it up as well.
Absolutely. But from opening face-off to the end of the game, it'd just be relentless. And I just can't imagine that, you know, if you go into rinks and you're playing teams and, you know, they've got like 6'6" tough guys, or they've got, you know, real strong fighters and stuff like that. I imagine, as much as you might not want to face playing them, I imagine it's players like Bruce Richardson that you hate the most, because they're just always there yapping constantly and jabbing you and sticking you and things like that. And it was just so relentless from every game, but he bought the passion and he bought the energy to every game. And like you say, he backed it up. Off the top of my head, I can think of five fights he had that were absolutely fantastic and real sort of highlights. He had the three fight series with Finity, and that first fight he had at the arena was
one of the best fights I think I've ever
seen. Just pure slugfest. I remember someone asking him, I think, I can't remember if it was on the radio thing that they did, or if it was one of the match interviews or in the post, but someone that said about, like, oh, you know, have you got history with Finity? And he said, I'd never heard of him before. He said, until I came here, I'd never heard of him, but I was told that he's their version of me. And I the first time that we played them, they square off at center ice for my first face off, and they do that. He's never even, you know, he has no reason to do it. He has no idea. There's no history there whatsoever. That was the type of player he was. He knew what he had to do, and he was willing to do it. And then they fought two more times that season as well, and they were pretty good. He fought Danny Stewart at Christmas, and TKOs him twice. So he drops him with a punch, and Danny Stewart gets back up again. And I imagine he probably wishes he'd stayed down first time, because he gets put down again. And I think that was the famous Team Hollywood game as well. And then obviously the Jason Hewitt fight. Let's be honest, Hewitt's made some comments in the press, I believe, about Panthers. And I think off one of the opening face-offs, I think Bergen offers to fight him and he turns it down. And then for the rest of the game, Richardson's chirping at him, trying to get him to go. And then there's a spell where there's a whistle and Richardson's just sort of like following him around like a shadow, trying to get him to fight, till eventually you can see the reluctance in Hewitt, just sort of like, oh, let's just get it out of the way. And let's be honest, the start of that fight, Hewitt wins. And then Richardson goes down, I don't think for a punch, but sort of like loses an edge and sort of goes to the ice. And then Hewitt makes the mistake of rather than like either chucking one in or just sort of like falling on top of him, he lets Richardson back up. And then we all know what happens next. You know, one of my favourite hockey photos ever is seeing James Kavanagh, the linesman, skating off with an incredibly bloody Jason Hewitt, because he's just been absolutely cut open by a punch from Bruce. One of the things I always remember that summed him up was, I think he fought Stuart Kerr in Nottingham when we played Hull, in the whole Rick Kozak game.
Yes,
I think Kerr throws a hit on Clark. It's quite dirty. And obviously Stuart Kerr's a big boy, and Richardson just steams in and just fights him. No second question. No, there was no sort of like coming over and having a chat or like pointing a finger at him and saying, you know, like, oh, you need to stop doing that. He just the gloves were off and he just jumped him. One of my favorite images I will always have of Bruce was of him jawing and squaring up to Brad Voth, and there must have been a foot and a half difference between the two of them on skates. And he's sort of like looking, his neck's craned, like trying to make eye contact with Brad Voth. but he didn't care.
I have a memory of Richardson in Belfast when Sean McMorrow played for the Giants. An opening face-off, McMorrow generally took the opening face-off on the wing, and Bruce Richardson lines up next to him, and I'm like, please, Bruce, don't go with McMorrow. It will end very badly for you. And thankfully, nothing happened, but just the fact he had the brass balls to just stand there with Sean McMorrow and make you think that he would even think about going with him.
Absolutely, because ultimately, if that's any other player on the team, you know, if that's like Johan Molin or something like that, you don't bat an eyelid because you know nothing's going to happen. But with it being Bruce, you can't help but think he's not, is he? Is he actually going to try and fight Sean McMorrow? What's he doing? Because he just didn't care. You see these stories about players, you know, like, oh, they bleed black and gold, or they bleed orange when they play at Sheffield and that sort of thing. He really was a heart and soul guy. You know, he would put his body on the line for the club. He was a fan's favourite, and I will always remember the first game that we played against Brayhead when he was there as player coach, and where I used to sit, the fans absolutely loved Bruce Richardson, and there was at least four or five people around me that had Bruce Richardson on the back of their shirts from the season before, and they were really excited to see him again and see him play. And then within, I'm going to say 5 minutes at best, they were outraged with him about how dirty he was, screaming at the referees to get him in the penalty box and stuff like that. And I was like, this is no different to what he's done the previous 2 years. It's just that when it was in our colours, it was completely fine and we loved it. But now we've realised actually he's a really horrible, horrible player.
Okay, let's go on to your final forward choice. So, Andy, who's forward number three?
My third and final choice is Lee Jinman.
So Lee Jinman, two spells with the Panthers. First in the Ice Hockey Super League, 94 games, 28 goals and 78 assists. Then coming back for his second spell when Panthers were in their first season in the Elite Ice Hockey League after he was cut by Timra in the SHL. 36 games, 25 goals and 41 assists. And of course, a Challenge Cup in 2004. Andy, you would have seen Jinman both in the Super League and in the Elite League. So what was it about him that made you choose him as your final forward?
Absolute wizard. Just completely and insanely skillful and a joy to watch. The thing that really stands out for me is if you look at the year he came into the Elite League, and obviously I appreciate that the standard of the Elite League wasn't like it was in the Super League. But he came back into the Elite League and played in the league games alone. I think it was 26 games in the league, and he got 47 points, which is 1.81 points per game. Now, Ling was 1.71 points per game, and I appreciate that, you know, there's that you can't really compare eras or players from so long, but you can't help but look at that and think Ling was exceptional and is probably one of the greatest players we'll ever see. And this guy came back and got more points per game than Linger did in his spell here, in that Grand Slam season. He just seemed to beat people with ease. He'd glide past players. His stick work was phenomenal. I used to sit behind the goal in the early days that I started going down, and he was the first player I ever saw use the back of the net to beat players. And he would just pass the puck off the back of the net back to himself. And defensemen would just be completely bamboozled by him. Just unreal talent. And at the time, obviously, he had that connection with Cadot that season when he came back. And they were just unreal. They were almost unplayable at times. And just a really, really good player. We went on holiday to Austria. My dad was working. And we went across to Austria. And we found out that Salzburg were playing Wielak, which was the other side of Austria, but we drove down to go and watch it because that's where Jinman had gone after he'd left us. And we drove down and went down for a game. And it's the most surreal game I've ever seen because it's not the family sport that we have in the UK, let's put it that way. So after every goal that the away team scored, the fans would throw stuff onto the ice and they'd be booing, they'd be swearing, they'd be trying to throw things at players. And the scoreline was 9-10 to Salzburg. So it happened 10 times. And Jimin got 3 goals and 4 assists that game. He was just different class. He was so good. And he was the first sort of player, again, the first player I saw that I started coming down where I thought, wow, that guy is like, he's by far the best player on the team. I love watching him play. And I figure as well, Jono, that you quite like him.
I do like Lee Jimin. I did like him a lot. A very, very skillful player, like you say. And he brought another dimension. And he was sort of stereotypical of the forwards you used to get in the Super League era, where the quality was just outstanding. And he was just, like you say, a different class. And then when he came back, when it was the Elite League, and to think we had John Craighead in that team as well, and Mark Cadot, it was just explosive firepower.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's one of the things, I remember him being good in my first year, but as I sort of mentioned, that first year that I'm going, I'm 12 years old, I've never watched the sport before. You can appreciate the players that are better than the others, but you can't really understand it because you don't really know the game. But by the time he came back after he'd had that spell away, I understood the game a bit better. I kind of knew what was happening a lot more. And I say it was just the buzz when he signed. I felt the buzz when he signed in terms of, like, obviously it's pre-Twitter and Facebook, but you'd go onto the cage and people would be excited. And we talk about things on threads and forums and stuff. And then obviously that first game that he's back in the arena, there's a real atmosphere about his return. And then obviously he comes back and does what he did. He's a real big linchpin as the first piece of silverware that I ever saw us lift. A really phenomenal, exceptional talent.
So that concludes your team, which is Rastislav Rovinjanec in goal, a defence of Mike Rees and Corey Nielsen, and a forward line of Barry Nicar, Bruce Richardson and Lee Jimin. I think it's fair to say that is a lineup that no one would like to face.
I think it's a lineup that none of your other guests are going to pick either, to be honest. I think you're pretty safe. There's going to be no repetition on my part.
But that is a formidable team. A lot of penalty minutes. It could certainly get a lot of time on the power play, the opposition, with that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Of course, we'd like you to let us know who almost made your team. So who were the other players that you considered?
Oh, well, K-Wall, obviously, for Netminder. Because he's probably the only other netminder, I think, that potentially you can talk about. It's the sort of defenceman I had, Beckett and Jimmy Pack, they were pretty close. Again, Pack probably failed based on the fact that it was the first two seasons. And although he was so good and so calm and such a smooth skater, that I could tell that he was very, very good. I just figured that I was probably slightly too young to appreciate him. And then forward-wise, you know, someone like Clarkey, who's been around forever. Ling, Beauregard, and a personal favourite of mine was always Dan Tessier.
He was a quality player.
Yeah, it just, you know, again, he was one of them players that you could chuck on in the last minute of a game. If you got a face-off in your own zone, you win him by a goal, you send on Dan Tessier because you knew he was going to win that face-off. And he also did one of the greatest things I've ever seen in a hockey game as well, where it was the first year that they brought in the you can't change on an icing. And we iced the puck, and Dan Tessier was not on the ice. And we iced the puck, and he moved whoever the netminder was, the backup netminder at the time, it's probably Woolley, I guess, Jeff Woolhouse. He moved him out of the way, opened the door, stepped onto the ice, skated a yard, turned around, and then skated off the ice. And the referee skated over and went, no, back on you come. Saw you skating off, back on you come. And Tessier came on, won the face-off, and then jumped back off the ice again. And it was one of the things that I can't believe no one else has ever tried it. It seems like such an easy and obvious trick to try and con
the
refs.
Probably easier to do with when it was three officials rather than the four that we've got it, now.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess ultimately, the linesman or a ref just literally looks up and sees a player trying to leave the ice, and straight away they're like, "No, back on you go." He was brilliant. He really was great. And obviously, that first year that he came, he was head and shoulders the best player. And it's no surprise that he was snapped up. And then obviously when he came back after being at Sheffield, I'm amazed that we didn't win anything that year with the players and the quality that we had. I actually watched that Sam Webster documentary that was made that year about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think it was called Beyond the Tunnel or something. It's sort of like a bit of a documentary about the team that season. And just looking through the locker room and that, you sort of think, how did they not win anything? You know, players like Brandon Cook, Galbraith, Tessier, Nielsen, Clark, Richardson, Bergen. You sort of think, how did they not win?
Ruben Under looking after them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think he'll probably get picked by many because I don't think he was here for, he was here for like a year and a bit. And obviously, I think a few people were soured by his first season and then subsequent signing for Sheffield. But he was different class. I liked him.
If you had to pick one of those honourable mentions as one who would have almost made your team, who would it be?
Probably Ling, to be fair. As much as I've just raved about Tessier, Ling is exceptional. And ultimately, I don't think my words can do it justice. I think Paul summed it up perfectly in the first episode. He was guaranteed to get you points and a ton of them, both goals and assists. I mean, he played beyond the edge, let's be brutally honest. I'm sure whichever Glebe brother it was in Coventry still has a bruise on the back of his kneecaps from that slash at the end of a game that we'd won like three, four goals. And there was like a 10 seconds left in the game. There was no need for it whatsoever. But he did it and got away with it. But that's just the sort of player. He was horrible. He absolutely horrible. But yeah, he probably would have been in there had it not been for, a few sort of fonder memories from earlier on in my childhood.
Okay, we're going to move on to the final section of, I suppose, your history of watching the Nottingham Panthers, and we always finish with your favourite moment. So, Andy, your favourite moment in your whole of your Panthers supporting career?
It would be Coventry in 2010. I think it was December the 4th, 2010. Where I witnessed my first ever bench clearance.
Of course, the famous Coventry Blaze Nottingham Panthers bench clearance game, where Brad Cruikshank, being taken off the ice, breaks free of the officials and rugby tackles Craig Kowalski, and all hell breaks loose straight after. I was watching that on the webcast, so I obviously got the joy of Dave Sims' commentary, which was fantastic.
It's very good.
Especially with the direction of the cameraman to tell him to film.
He does go from commentator to director in an instant. It's like, pan left.
But of course, you was actually there at the Sky Dome that night. So just what was it like being there for that?
It was incredible. It was really good. I wasn't there for the Sheffield game. It's before I started coming, and I'd never witnessed anything like it. And it was, I mean, if you speak to Lou, there's not many times she's seen me that excited. I was like a child at Christmas. I was like, my face was aglow. I was jumping up and down. Like, and this is like 20 minutes after it's finished. I'm still just completely buzzing by this. And it was surreal. We went in with a game plan that was quite clearly to harass Brett Yeager.
I remember watching it on the webcast. It was brutal treatment.
We didn't really touch on the fact that when I chose McGrattan's goal, we got knocked out of that playoff quarterfinal by Sheffield, and it left a sour taste because obviously Weekman got injured by John Armstrong hitting him, and then obviously they won on the backup netminder. But our treatment of Brett Yeager that day was insane. I think in the first sort of 5 minutes, I think Penner had ran him twice. Matt Myers ended up running him, and Penner ran him again. So at least four times he'd been hit by Panthers players, and three of them were by Penner. And let's be brutally honest, you know, if it happens once, you sort of, you say, oh, you know, that's unlucky. If it happens twice, you think, well, it might be a coincidence. If it happens three times, you think, hang on, there's something fishy. And if it happens four times and three of them have been the same player, then come on. it's crazy. So I think in terms of actually starting the brawl, that is 100% the reason why it happens. I think, but I think there's a few more deciding factors. I think the fact that Darnell didn't call any of them as penalties. So I think obviously Panther's game plan was to get into Jaeger's face and get under his skin, and in some instances actually make contact with him. I don't think Darnell helped by not penalising any of it. So obviously that would have got under the skin of Coventry. I think if one of the players that Coventry had that year, if the rest weren't going to call a penalty, I think if Jason Robinson or Cruikshank, if they just drop the gloves with Penner, it probably settles down and that's fine. And then it just goes a little bit weird in the sense of, I think Cruikshank trips up Mark Leavers. Cruikshank gets called for tripping. Mark Leavers, I think, gets called for embellishment, and they both go to the penalty box. And then whilst in the penalty box, if I remember correctly, Brad Cruikshank makes an obscene hand gesture towards Tom Darnell and is chucked out for an obscene gesture. And obviously, as he's skating off the ice, he thinks, no, I'm going to go and have a chat with Kowalski. Makes a beeline for Kowalski, who sort of submarines him a bit. And then all hell breaks loose, and you've got players jumping over the boards. You've got players jumping out of the penalty box. Obviously, Leavers was in the penalty box at the time, and Penner was also in there. For something else, and just all hell breaks loose. You've got Penner teeing off on poor old Brian Lee. It's not very often that I feel sorry for Coventry players, but the first fight, you sort of think, oh, you know, fair enough, Penner's just probably given him a bit of a pasting. But then, it all sort of goes down the other end of the ice, and they're just sort of holding on to each other with nothing happening. And then, out of nowhere, Penner just decides to carry on. And just tease off on him again. And Brian Lee just really doesn't want any of it. And there's nothing he can do about it. You've got, I think, Stevie Lee and Robert Farmer. Obviously, the main event sort of becomes Jason Robinson and Lapine. And that's right down the other end of the ice. So you've got Lapine and Robinson go toe-to-toe in a decent scrap. And then Lapine and Robinson get put in the penalty box. And Brett Jaeger then tries to fight Lapine in the penalty box. Danny Myers comes in and just jumps him.
Oh, Danny Myers, you got beaten to hell for that.
Absolutely. And it just, it's one of those things where it's sort of, every time you thought it was going to die down,
it
something happened
again, yeah.
And it just sort of sparked it all. I say, while all this is happening down that end of the ice, away from the Panthers fans, you've got Penner deciding to carry on with Brian Lee for no reason whatsoever. By now, obviously, Penner's shirt's off. It's attached to his fight strap and it's dangling on the ice, and there's that hilarious bit where he's skating to get back involved. Corey's trying to calm him down, and he sort of stands on his own shirt and falls over. And I sponsored Penner that year, and obviously he left after Christmas and went back home. But there was no hesitation in my mind when I got the email from the club asking me which shirt I wanted that year. As gold sponsor of Penner, that I was having that black shirt from that game, and it is absolutely annihilated. The amount of rips, tears, holes, it's got 20p in it as well. So if I'm ever short of any cash, I can always go into my Penner shirt and break open the 20p that he used as a second tie down for the front of his shirt. It's again, other than my Dennis Maxwell shirt, which is my favorite because obviously it was so cheap. The Penner one is by far my second favourite because of the fact that it was part of this game, and the fact that it's got some serious damage to it. And there's not many events in my time watching hockey that has compelled me to write a nearly 2,000 word essay and post on Hockey Fight on dropyourgloves.com. But I did for this game. And it's fantastic. It's really good. I mean, it kind of ruined our season because we were doing quite well that year. And then obviously K-Wall was injured off the back of it. And we went a couple of games, I think, with Dan Green. And then we brought in Kevin St-Pierre, I think, came back for a few games.
Yes.
And although obviously that helped as opposed to having a Brit backup for those games, it sort of derailed our season a little bit because we were going quite well, I think, up until then. Obviously, we hadn't hit the Christmas peak, the Christmas dip, so there was always that chance it was going to go south anyway, but it sort of felt like it was a bit of a real sting of the fact that, as great as it was, we ended up losing Kowalski for a few games off the back of it, because I think he did his groin.
Yes, he did.
Which probably would have been from the combination of flipping Brad Cruikshank over his back and Danny Myers clattering into him trying to stop it all. So, but yeah, just phenomenal experience. And I genuinely, honestly cannot say whether we won that game or not. I have no idea.
We lost 2-1.
There you go.
I remember the third period was just seemed to go at a pedestrian pace. It just happened. Yeah. You know, there was no controversy or anything like that.
I know there's another fight. There was another collision with a goalie, and Greg Zanon fought someone. I can't remember who it was though. But for some reason I will always remember him. He got a ginger beard and wore number 5 for Coventry. Just odd how you remember these sort of things. It might have been Brad Sanders as opposed to Greg. But there was another fight in the game, but ultimately it was really quite vanilla for the rest of the match in comparison. But yeah, I mean, of all the things, you know, a game that we lost has turned into my favourite moment.
Well, that brings us to the end. Andy, it's been a great chat. I love listening to your stories, so thanks very, very much for taking part.
No worries, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to you for listening. We will be back soon with another edition of My Top 9, but from me, for now, thanks very much and goodbye.